Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC and New York Times columnist Joe Nocera is back with us to talk money, guns, and maybe some other things. Hi, Joe. Welcome back to the BL Show.
Hi, Brian.
You've been writing a blog on the Times website. I don't know how many of our listeners have seen it, even if they read the print edition, called The Gun Report, a short paragraph about every gun death in America since the Newtown Massacre.
Well,
everyone
we can find. And to give credit where it's due, my assistant, Jennifer Massica, compiles them, and then I edit it and write an intro, and, mm-hmm. and it's basically it's a gun violence aggregation site. What a weird thing to say, but that's right. What it is.
And I see that you're drawing from media reports, local media all over the country, wherever a gun death might have been big enough to make the media, and the number of total gun deaths since Newtown is now over 4,100. What's the goal of your gun report?
Bear witness, really? Here's the long answer. I feel after Newtown, many people were galvanized, including myself. I'm a journalist. I'm an opinion journalist, so that gives me more leeway to say things and do things. But fundamentally, I'm a journalist. I can't start an organization. I can't join an organization. So I wrote a column that was simply a compilation of some gun deaths that had taken place around the country that week. And I had not editorialized in that column at all. It had just – all it had was a compilation. And it was unbelievably powerful. And I had so many to choose from. That's the sad thing. And out of that, I decided that people don't really realize what goes on every day in terms of gun violence in the country. You're in your little town or your large town. You only see really what goes on in your town unless there's a mass shooting somewhere. And you don't realize that every single day some five-year-old finds a gun under the bed and shoots his two-year-old sister. That is not an uncommon occurrence. Every day there are drive-by shootings. Every day people are getting randomly struck. Every day people erupt in anger, take out a gun and shoot somebody. The carelessness, the sort of lack of thought, the lack of safety, I just thought compiling this on a daily basis and really trying to show what goes on in the United States in terms of guns was a worthwhile thing to do.
You broke one out recently to write up in your print edition column about a guy who left his house unoccupied for months at a time and left a loaded gun lying around when he was gone. Why did you pick that one to put in the actual Times?
Well, actually, that's a slightly different situation because that was an older – that would not have made the gun report because that took place last October.
Okay.
And what happened in that case, I read my reader emails, and somebody sent me an email out of the blue saying, I want to tell you about this case. And she didn't really have an expectation that I would write about it, I don't think. But it was – The need for gun owners to change the culture, their own culture, and be more careful with their guns was something that I've been thinking about for a while. I really support an organization called Evolve, a new organization in New York that's trying to, you know, start up ad campaigns and so on that are like the old Mothers Against Drunk Driving things, only related to guns. And so, to me, this was such a it's like, so how hard is it to lock up your gun when you're going back to Wisconsin for 3 months? It was incomprehensible to me that the gun owner would not have done that. And the reason, so that's the reason I chose to write about it. And then, of course, I called the gun owner. I got his wife on the phone, and she said, "We're as much victims as anybody else here," which I thought to be one of the single most shocking quotes I've ever gotten in my entire journalistic career.
She was as much of a victim because?
I guess they've suffered. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And
you
did call for a policy change there, a change in the law where somebody who did what he did could be held criminally liable, right?
Well, I think they should be already. I mean, with children, for instance, Brian, you know, reckless endangerment laws are on the books in all 50 states. And yet, there's a case in New Jersey recently where the parent was indicted for reckless endangerment. But by and large, prosecutors believe the parents have suffered enough, and they also believe that there are so many bad guys, you know, they're trying to catch who shoot people on purpose. What's the point of prosecuting someone when somebody gets shot accidentally? But I strongly believe that this is the one case where the NRA is actually right. The NRA basically says, enforce the laws that are on the books. Absolutely right. If you began truly enforcing laws around gun safety and reckless endangerment, you would stop some of this behavior because it would send a message to everybody else. It's like sending Jeff Skilling to jail for Enron. At least for a short time, it affects the behavior of all the other potentially crooked CEOs. That's one of the reasons we do prosecutions, not just to punish the person who's guilty, but to send a message to everybody else.
New York Times columnist Joe Nocera with us. Let me take one phone call for you on this, and then I want to go on to IRS. George in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC.
Hello?
With George Joe Nocera. George, you there? Hey, George? All right, we'll give George a chance
Hello?
To come back. In the Oh, George, you there?
George? Hello?
Yes, George, can you hear me?
I'm holding it.
Okay, so George can't hear me. We'll see if we can fix that up. And for everybody else, 212-433-WNYC to talk to Joe Nocera this morning, 212-433-9692. I'm curious if you have a take on the IRS scandal that goes beyond the outrage that everybody feels if one political group is being treated differently from another based on their political category. I saw the very interesting New York Times opinionator section on the app today about whether 501c4s should be done away with altogether or reformed because they're so easily set up as fake social welfare agencies that are really fronts for campaign spending.
But the thing about it is there's nothing even fake. Nobody's even bothering to fake it. The painful thing about this particular case, what the IRS did with the Tea Party, is it's going to make it impossible to do what actually needs to be done, which is to shut all these down, or at least take away their tax benefits from the left, the center, and the right if they're involved in politics. The 501c4 is defined as a social welfare organization. That's the definition. But both the Federal Election Commission and the IRS has basically not had the nerve to question their tax status. The FEC, because it's a supine agency to begin with, and the IRS, I assume, one would have assumed it's because they were worried about the gnarly politics of trying to stop this, but the fact that they would go after the Tea Party is basically incomprehensible, but it's really set back the cause of campaign reform enormously.
Do you know why C4s are tax exempt in the first place? I mean, in case people don't know, they're not exactly charities like the Red Cross or cultural institutions like us, which get 501c3 charitable status. That's for actual charities or cultural institutions. These are unions and the NRA and the Sierra Club and the AARP, just to throw it all across the political spectrum with those examples, all of which we think of as substantially political. So why did Congress think in the first place that that merited a tax-exempt status like an actual charity does?
Well, I don't really have a good answer to that. I do think the distinction that Congress generally meant was supporting a cause isn't quite the right word, but supporting a social policy like, for instance, the environment, they said that was worthy of tax-exempt status. But to them, the law was meant to cross the line at the point at which you're contributing to candidates or lobbying directly to Congress. That's supposed to be a violation that would rid you of your tax-exempt status. What's happened over the years is that first lobbying came in, and nobody had the nerve to stop it, to say, hey, you can't do this. And then so there's this kind of creeping mission change. First began the lobbying. And then when they realized that that wasn't going to cost them the tax status, then the next thing, let's give, quote-unquote, money for causes, which the Koch brothers, you know, kind of perfected, not to pick on them because I actually don't think they do anything worse than anybody on the left does. I'm sure you'll get calls about that. And then the next step after that is, let's give to the candidate directly. And because the IRS at no point along the way said, no, you can't do this, now it's almost too late.
Well, now this is mostly about how they give to super PACs, but I hear what you're saying. Now I think we have George in Brooklyn. Hello. George, you there?
Hello.
Hello, George. George, you're still no, huh? All right, maybe the problem is his line. Let's try Angel in Westchester, who wants to talk back to you on guns. Angel, can you hear me?
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Angel? All right, they are not hearing me. So let's go on. Joe, we'll go on to another topic. Dow 15,000. Most of the coverage has been Dow 15,000. Woohoo, whoopee, happy days are here again on Wall Street. But I'm wondering, why is the Dow more than double what it was a few years ago at the bottom of the financial crisis, while unemployment remains high and wage stagnation remains high for most workers? Why are they so out of kilter with each other?
Well, wage stagnation is a long-term 30-year trend, and it's sort of not going to affect the Dow one way or the other. In fact, it might actually help the Dow because it means that corporations are keeping their labor costs down. There's two things going on here, Brian, I think. You'll also notice some recent stories about how the deficit has been shrinking faster than anybody expected.
Yeah.
So there is some clearly a fair amount of economic upturn and economic activity that's not necessarily reflected in the unemployment statistics. But the second part is that, you know, companies have learned to get more productivity out of the people that they do employ, do with fewer people. And so basically their profits are really quite high. And also don't forget that the large multinationals get 50% or more of their profits from overseas. So it's not purely a function of their success is not purely a function of the American economy anymore. There's another factor that's probably the most important, which is that the Federal Reserve monetary policy has basically been a catapult for the stock market by keeping bond prices so ridiculously low, by flooding the economy, by flooding the markets with money, by buying up all these bonds and their various programs. Ben Bernanke has made it extremely attractive to buy stocks. So part of the reason stocks are going up has nothing to do with the economy whatsoever. It purely is a function of Federal Reserve maneuverings. And it does make me wonder, it makes me think back to the Alan Greenspan days, irrational exuberance, and whether we are, in fact, going through another round of that.
Huh. George in Brooklyn, third time's a charm.
Hello?
Ha-ha, we got you.
Yeah, okay. Mr. Nocera, I missed your column on I thought you were tracking deaths between siblings.
no,
there was
I'm
a
not.
Sibling, there was a sibling murder in the last week. A 12-year-old in California stabbed his 8-year-old sister to death, but I didn't see the same column that I saw about the Kentucky.
But what's your question?
So are you trying to make a point about knives versus guns?
Oh, no, I wouldn't do that. The question I wanted to ask was, in the gun deaths project that you're running, do you count which deaths are caused by unregistered guns?
No, we
and
don't.
Why not?
We don't have the capability to do that. I don't have the ability to do that. I'm a guy with a really good assistant doing our best to pull this thing together every day, plus write my columns, plus trying to write a book on the side, plus trying to have a family life. I mean, give me a break. I have no ability to know which guns are registered and which guns are unregistered. I don't have those kind of statistics. I don't have that kind of research capability. And I don't even know if the police can figure that out when they probably can, but given all the restrictions on what law enforcement can and cannot do thanks to the NRA, I don't even know that that's gettable information.
But if you've got a policy point behind keeping the gun deaths report going of saying, hey, we need those background checks, then do you need that stat to really make the case?
No, you don't need that stat to make the case. I mean, my God. we know as a country that many people are killed, wounded, robbed, etc., with guns that don't belong to them. On some level, it's like, well, I mean, I'm in favor. They go crazy when you say this, but I don't see what's so wrong with a national registry. If somebody uses a gun to shoot somebody that's not theirs, shouldn't you be able to trace where that gun came from, who you got it from, where the provenance of the gun was? I don't understand what the problem with that is at all. But, you know, I'm a liberal from the New York Times, yada, yada.
What's your take on the Eric Holder too big to jail remarks? He first said big Wall Street firms are sometimes too big to prosecute because too many innocent people get hurt if the financial system goes wobbly because the government is bringing down a huge banking giant. Then he recanted this week and said, no bank is too big to jail. Did you follow that back and forth?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to blow my punchline for my column tomorrow, but basically Eric Holder is the single worst cabinet appointment Obama has made.
Ooh.
And he proves that day in and day out. And too big to jail is just part of it. I mean, when you look at what, you know, he's got all these other problems now with the AP and that thing, what was it called, the thing having to do with the AFT with the guns in Mexico.
Right, that where they distributed the guns to try to track them
right.
In Mexico. Yes,
and
fast and furious.
Fast and furious. He's got all these problems. But go back to the mortgage scandal. I continue to ask, has anybody from Countrywide been indicted by the Department of Justice? The answer continues to be no. I'm not talking about Angelo Mozzillo. I'm talking about anybody. And we know now that Countrywide was a criminal enterprise. We know that. It's well established. And we also know that the way this government has made believe that it's getting tough on crime in the wake of the mortgage crisis is throwing in jail all these small fry homeowners who lied on a liar loan and don't have the means to defend themselves in court. So they wind up taking some sentence, and then some prosecutor puts a notch on his belt. It is so offensive. And it's so shameful of, and it's part of the reason why nobody trusts government anymore. You find yourself in the crosshairs, and you're, if I could say this on the air, you're screwed.
Worst cabinet appointee of the Obama administration, Eric Holder, says Joe Nocera. By the way, I think I overstated Fast and Furious. They didn't distribute guns, but they were tracking them.
Right.
Rather than cracking down on them as quickly as they might have,
right,
looking for higher-ups. But Joe Nocera, New York Times columnist, always interesting. You make us think. Thank you very much.
Hey, Brian, thanks a lot. I always enjoy being on.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.